If you have ever spent a late night, digging into historical records, you're probably intimately familiar with a very specific and very agonizing flavor of frustration.
Oh, absolutely. The dreaded 2 a.m. brick wall.
Yes, exactly. Picture this. It is 2 a.m. You are staring at a blinking cursor. And you type a name, let's say Maxwell, into a search engine, hoping to unearth some 18th century Scottish parish records.
Right.
You hit enter, and the system cheerfully hands you every single document containing the exact string of letters, M-A-X-W-E-L-L.
Which, I mean, sounds helpful at first.
It sounds great, but the system is entirely literal. It completely ignores Makeswell, Macuswell, and Maxwell, and Maxwell with one L.
Yeah, to the database, those are completely different universes.
Exactly. But to you sitting there with your handwritten notes and a, a growing headache, you know they are the exact same family line.
It is the ultimate collision between the messy, chaotic reality of human history and the rigid mathematical nature of computer systems. We expect databases to understand human identity, but traditional search tools are completely blind to context. They don't know history. They only know character matching.
And that structural blindness is exactly what we are tackling in today's deep dive.
Yeah.
We're unpacking a brand new standard designed to bridge that gap, which is known as the Max Name Schema.
It's a huge leap forward.
It really is. Our mission today is to look at how this specific data structure is attempting to solve what we might just call the name problem. I want to know why the standard was built, how it actually functions under the hood, and we absolutely have to talk about the fascinating AI design council that stress tested the whole thing before it was released.
Oh, the council is the best part. But to understand why a completely new schema was even necessary, we have to look at the sheer scale of the name problem first.
Right, because it's not just about typos.
Not at all. When you examine historical records, name variation is this massive four-headed monster driven by history itself. The first head is anglicization, or, well, forced assimilation.
Okay, give me an example.
Think of the Irish Gaelic name O'Brien. When English colonial administrators were the ones holding the pens and maintaining the ledgers, that name was documented as O'Brien.
Wow, okay.
The identity was altered by the power dynamics of the era. The exact same thing happened when the Scottish Gaelic Mary was recorded officially as Mary.
So the person's actual lived name was one thing, but the official paper trail reflects something completely different.
Exactly.
So what are the other heads of the monster?
Well, the second head is translation and just the sheer phonetic drift of names over centuries. Consider the journey of the Hebrew name Yochanan.
Yochanan, okay.
As early texts were translated, it became the Latin Iohan. And as that spread into France, it morphed into Jean.
Oh, sure.
Across the English Channel, and it flattens into John. Stretch that exact same root eastward into Slavic languages, and you get Ivan.
That is genuinely mind-blowing. I mean, John and Ivan are the exact same name functionally, just filtered through different language trees.
Precisely. It carries the same cultural weight, the same baptismal root, but it is wearing entirely different linguistic clothes, depending on the century and the geography.
That is wild. Okay, so what's the third head?
Pure scribal error. Picture an exhausted German tax collector in 1840 who just decides that dropping in an umlaut is easier than writing it out, so Müller becomes Meller, M-L-L-E-R, on the official ledger.
Right.
Or a census taker who writes down Margaret instead of Margaret purely based on how they heard the person pronounce it on their front porch that afternoon.
A completely phonetic guess, basically.
Yes. And the final head is evolution over generations. So say a Portuguese family named Ferrero moves, the spelling fades into Ferreira, and eventually across the Atlantic over a few generations, it flattens out entirely into Ferro.
Okay, wait, let's unpack this for a second because I have to push back a little on the scribal error aspect.
Yeah.
If an 18th century tax collector was just lazy or perhaps barely literate and literally made up the spelling mill without the lout or wrote Makeswell because he had never actually seen the name written down, why do we need an incredibly complex database to legitimize a mistake?
Ah.
I mean, a typo is a typo, right?
Uh-huh.
Why canonize bad spelling?
That gets to the absolute core of historical research, actually. It's something we call the research gap.
The research gap.
Yeah. A historical record isn't about what a name should be in some perfect platonic ideal of grammar. It is about capturing what was actually written in the ink on the page.
Oh, I see.
If a genealogist is looking for their family in a tax ledger from 1740, the physical document says Müller. If your search system only accepts the grammatically correct Müller, that researcher will simply never find their ancestor.
Right. It's a dead end.
Exactly. Oh. The machine has to capture the reality of the document, errors and all.
Ah, so the goal isn't to say Mueller is grammatically correct. The goal is to prove that Mueller existed in this specific document at this specific time.
That is the crucial distinction, the provenance of the ink. And when the creators of Mac's name surveyed the landscape of existing genealogical tools, they found a complete graveyard of systems that failed to capture this.
Really? There was nothing out there.
I mean, they looked at WeRelate, which is a fantastic resource, but it's essentially just a wiki. There is no rigorous machine-readable schema underneath it.
Got it.
They looked at Behind the Name, but that is a proprietary read-only database that completely lacks the structural provenance for linking cognate relationships across different sources.
Well, what about the big institutions? I would assume the big institutional libraries would have solved this by now. Yeah. What about something like the Library of Congress Name Authority File?
The LCNF. It's built for an entirely different purpose.
Oh, yeah.
It exists to establish authoritative catalog names. It's about finding the one correct way to file a book by a specific author on a shelf. It is actively uninterested in tracking messy historical variants.
Ah, so it actually wants to ignore the mess.
Exactly. Even GEBCOMX, which is the massive standard used in genealogy right now, it lacks a strongly typed variant structure.
Yeah.
None of those tools could capture typed, directed, provenance-bearing historical variant relationships across time and languages.
That is a massive void.
It is. And that void is why Mac's name was built.
Let's talk about how it was built then, because the design process is unlike anything I have ever seen for a data standard. Human engineers have struggled with this complexity for decades, so the Mac's Name team did something radical.
They really did.
They stress-tested the initial schema using a three-brain council of AI models, which is just, how does a human team actually set up an AI tribunal to critique software architecture?
Well, they essentially built a multi-agent simulation. Yeah. They took the draft schema and fed it into an environment where three different large language models were assigned specific personas, and then they were instructed to debate each other.
It's amazing.
Yeah, they brought in Grok 3 to act as the engineer lens, evaluating the pure computational logic and efficiency. Then they used Qwen 3.1RB as the contrarian lens. They explicitly prompted it to try and break the system, find edge cases, and expose logical flaws.
I love that. Just a designated troublemaker.
Exactly. And finally, they used Claude as the operator lens, which was focused entirely on the user experience, how a historian or a genealogist would actually interact with the data in the real world.
That is absolutely fascinating. So they aren't just asking an AI to check their code for typos. They're forcing different models to argue over the philosophical and technical implications of the design.
And the results were profound, honestly. This council didn't just rubber stamp the human draft. They forced massive fundamental improvements into the schema before it ever saw the light of day.
Like what?
Well, for example, they completely overhauled how the system categorizes variants.
Okay, explain that, because the sources mentioned something called URI extensible variant types, which, frankly, sounds incredibly dense.
It sounds dense, but the logic is brilliant. So in the original draft, the human engineers created a closed list of how a name could vary.
A drop-down menu, basically.
Right. The system allowed you to tag a variant as a spelling variant, an abbreviation, or a phonetic shift. The AI council immediately flagged this as a massive ossification risk.
Oh, I can see why. It is like trying to write a dictionary of every slang word that will ever exist. You are inevitably going to miss something, and the moment a new type of slang appears, your entire dictionary structure is basically obsolete.
That is the perfect analogy. The list of ways names vary across human history is simply not finite. What happens when a researcher encounters, say, forced administrative reassignments during an obscure 19th century border change?
Right.
Or culturally specific naming shifts that Western engineers haven't even categorized yet. If the schema relies on a closed, hard-coded list, adding a new category requires breaking the software to update it.
So what did the council suggest instead?
The council demanded that the variant type field accept URIs instead of fixed text.
Okay, for those of us who aren't software engineers, what exactly is a URI in this context?
URI stands for Uniform Resource Identifier. Think of it like a highly specific web link. Instead of choosing from a preset menu of tags, an implementer can insert a URI that points to an external, community-defined vocabulary.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah, they can drop in a link that points directly to an academic definition of forced legal substitutions during immigration, for example. By doing this, the standard can grow endlessly to accommodate new historical discoveries without the core software ever breaking.
That is incredibly elegant. And it leads right into the next major intervention from the council, which was variant IDs.
Yes.
The draft schema apparently just listed the alternate spellings, but the AI council pushed back and demanded that every single variant get its own UUID. Why does a spelling need a UUID?
So a UUA is a universally unique identifier. It's a complex 128-bit number that acts as a digital fingerprint. Let's say a researcher inputs that 1743 Dumfriesshire Parish Record spelling of Makeswell.
Okay.
By assigning it a UUID, that specific drop of ink on that specific historical page gets its own independent digital identity.
Wait, it is almost like version control. If I am collaborating on a coding project using GitHub and I introduce a bug, my team can revert just my specific commit without deleting the entire software program.
That is exactly the mechanism at play. If a genealogist realizes 5 years later that the 1743 document actually said Makeswell and the original transcription was flawed, that specific variant can be independently retracted or corrected.
Without ruining everything else.
Right. You don't have to blow up the entire parent record from the Makeswell family to fix one mistake. It localizes the blast radius of human error.
Which brings up the most contentious part of historical research human disagreement. The sources highlight that the council added a disputed by array to the schema.
Oh, yes. Because historians love to argue, and historical data is rarely settled fact.
Very true.
Previously, most databases forced a binary resolution. If two scholars disagreed on whether a name was a typo or a deliberate change, the database administrator had to pick a winner.
And the loser's context was just erased from the system.
Exactly. It was just gone. Hmm.
But with a disputed by array, both perspectives coexist in the code.
Yes. The system can hold the variant, cite the scholar disputing it, explain the exact nature of the controversy, and leave the data intact. It respects the scholarly debate as a vital part of the historical record, rather than forcing the computer to play dictator.
That is so important. Let's talk about the final big intervention from the AI Council, which involves cognate direction. We talked earlier about Yohanan turning into John and Ivan. How did the council change how those relationships are actually mapped?
Well, the AI models recognize that linguistic evolution is directional, and the original draft didn't account for that at all.
What do you mean?
John did not spawn Ivan. Ivan did not spawn John. They are parallel adaptations springing from the exact same Latin root, Iohans.
Oh, yeah.
So the council added specific relationship fields. Now you can tag a connection as this derives from, the source of, or parallel cognate.
Because tracing Makeswell back to its old Norse root of Macus is a straight chronological line, not a parallel track.
Right, exactly.
That level of detail is just astounding. Okay, so now that we understand the philosophical rules set by this AI tribunal, I want to look under the hood. Let's walk through the actual anatomy of a max name record, piece by piece.
Sure. The structure is incredibly logical once you see how the layers stack on top of each other. It begins at the very top with the anchor, which the schema calls the canonical form.
Right.
But we need to clarify what canonical means here, because the documentation is very careful to avoid English supremacy in its design.
Yeah, the canonical form isn't declaring the ultimate superior version of a name, right?
Correct. It is simply a reference point, usually the most common modern spelling used to anchor the data, but it works in tandem with an array called regional canonical.
How does that work?
So you might have the given name John sitting in the primary canonical field, but right alongside it in the regional array, the system holds Sain as the authority for Irish Gaelic.
Oh, I see.
It holds Eowyn for Scottish Gaelic, Eowyn for Welsh, and Johan for German.
So they're all equally valid, authoritative regional anchors.
Mm.
No single language is treated as the correct baseline.
Exactly. It's totally egalitarian. From that anchor, we drop down into the variance array, and this is where the schema really flexes its muscles. Every single alternate spelling ever recorded is stored here.
Wow.
It holds the UUID we talked about, the exact text as it appeared in the historical document, the URI for the variant type, and its specific scope.
Scope meaning the specific locale, language, script, and time period where that spelling was used.
Yes. And crucially, it captures frequency within that scope.
Frequency?
Yeah. A specific spelling might be tagged as dominant, meaning it accounts for over 60% of occurrences in 17th century Dumfriesshire. But that exact same spelling might be classified as rare, under 5% in 20th century America.
So the database is literally tracking the popularity of a spelling across time and space.
It really is.
But what happens when a modern researcher doesn't know the historical spelling? If I type Maxwell, how does the database know to bridge the gap to Makeswell if I didn't explicitly type it?
Ah, that is where the next layer of the schema comes in, the phonetic keys. MaxName computes and stores the results of 6 different fuzzy searching algorithms.
Let's define fuzzy searching for the listener real quick. This isn't AI, right? These are mathematical formulas.
Correct. These are algorithms designed to strip away the vowels and group similar sounding consonants together. The oldest one built into the schema is SoundX.
How does SoundX actually work?
So SoundX was patented back in 1918. It retains the first letter of the name, drops all the vowels, and assigns a number to the remaining consonants based on how they are articulated in the mouth.
Okay.
So for Maxwell, it keeps the M, assigns a 2 to the X, and so on, creating a code like M240. Because Makeswell shares similar consonant sounds, it also computes to M240.
Ah. So when you search, the computer compares the phonetic codes, not the actual letters.
Exactly.
And the schema goes beyond just SoundX, right?
Oh, yes. It includes newer, much more sophisticated algorithms like Double Metaphone and Biter Morse, which is specifically designed to handle the complex phonetic rules of Eastern European and Ashkenazi Jewish names.
That's incredibly thorough.
It is, but the AI Council actually added a critical safeguard here regarding the algorithms.
Right, the algorithm version tag. Mm-hmm. The schema forces you to record the specific version of the algorithm you used. But, I mean, if SoundX is a mathematical equation from 1918, why would the version matter? Math doesn't change.
Math doesn't change, no, but software implementations absolutely do. Algorithms get revised, patched, and updated to handle edge cases all the time.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, a SoundX code computed in the year 2026 using one software library will not necessarily match a code computed in 2050 using a revised, updated version of that algorithm.
No.
If you just store the code M240 without tagging the exact version that generated it 50 years from now, your database will experience a silent collapse.
Because search queries will just fail to match, and the system won't understand why.
Exactly. Storing the algorithm version prevents that slow decay of the data.
It is essentially future-proofing the database against its own software updates. That's brilliant. Okay, so the final major component of the schema is the cognates array, which links records across completely different linguistic trees.
Yes.
But the documentation lays down a very strict rule for this section regarding the attestation source.
Right. This is where MaxName really enforces academic rigor. If a user wants to claim that the English John and the Russian Ivan are cognates, they cannot just drop that assertion into the database because it sounds right or, you know, they read it on a blog somewhere.
The schema requires an attestation source.
Meaning a formal citation.
Yes, like a published etymological dictionary, a peer-reviewed linguistic study, a verified historical text.
Exactly. Without a citation, the system treats it as a mere hypothesis. But with a citation, it becomes a verified finding that subsequent researchers can actually build upon with confidence.
Okay, to cement everything we've just walked through, I want to put the schema to the ultimate test. Let's run a messy real-world example through all these layers. Let's look at how MaxName processes the Maxwell family line, exactly as it's outlined in the sources.
I love this example. Let's trace the evolution step by step.
Okay, we start at the top, the canonical form. The anchor is Maxwell. The origin is listed as Old Norse, deriving from a location meaning Maccus's pool. And the database notes the first historical attestation is in 1144 CE.
So we have our baseline. Now we open the variance array and watch the history unfold.
Right. The earliest records don't say Maxwell. The database shows the spelling Maxwell. And the metadata tells us this was the dominant spelling found in Latin ecclesiastical documents stretching from 1144 to roughly 1300.
Notice how the schema isolates that variant to a specific language, Latin, and a specific era.
Exactly. Then, you know, time passes and the language shifts. By the time we enter the period of 1600 to 1750, we are looking at Scots Langer's records. The spelling is phoneticized into Makeswell.
And the system flags this not as dominant, but as an occasional frequency.
Right. Fast forward a bit more into the 19th century, and the clerks start shrinking it into the abbreviation Agaxwell with an apostrophe.
And this is where the historical debate enters the code via the disputed by array.
Yes, because when researchers look at colonial records from Virginia during this period, they find a very rare spelling, McAxwell. Now, at first glance, anyone would assume the clerk just made a scribal corruption, right? Accidentally blending McAkey into the name.
It seems obvious. But the dispute array shows us that the scholarly community isn't actually aligned on that assumption.
No, they aren't. The array flags the variant and cites a specific scholar who argues this was not a typo. They argue it was a deliberate, culturally motivated anglicization designed to make the name look like a traditional McDeck surname for social or administrative reasons in the colonies.
And because of the schema design, that debate lives directly inside the search tool. It doesn't break the database, but the academic context is perfectly preserved.
That's incredible.
If a user searches Maxwell, the phonetic keys, like the double metaphone code MKSL, will bridge the gap, pull up the Virginia document, and instantly present the user with the scholarly debate about their ancestors' identity.
And underneath it all, the cognates array firmly links the entire web back to that etymological root of Maccus, perfectly cited from Rini's Dictionary of English Surnames.
Consider the implications of what we're looking at here. This isn't just a search upgrade. It is a machine-readable map of human identity.
It really is.
Now, billing out this Max name dataset for every single historical name across every language on Earth is an unfathomably massive undertaking.
Sure. But the beauty of this project is that they aren't starting from scratch.
Not at all. The raw material already exists. It is sitting in Wiktionary. It is documented in Behind the Name. It is buried in the Family Search Research Wiki. The genius of the MaxName standard is that it operates under a CC BY license.
Let's clarify the CC BY license for a moment. That means the data is completely open and just requires attribution, right?
Yes. Creative Commons attribution. It means anyone, any university, any software company, any individual genealogist can use, adapt, and build upon the schema and the data set as long as they credit the source.
Which changes everything.
It turns name resolution from a fragmented proprietary competition into cumulative open source community work. We stop reinventing the wheel every time someone does genealogical research. We are essentially building a universal master key.
Which fundamentally changes the future of historical research.
Oh, completely. It means that within a few years, AI transcription models will be able to read a scanned 17th century parish record, highlight the handwritten word Makeswell, and instantly know it is Maxwell.
Wow.
A casual researcher will be able to type a name into a search bar and instantly pull up the entire linguistic geographic web of their family's history without having to manually guess how a tired tax collector might have misspelled it 300 years ago.
It is taking the ultimate messiness of human history, wrapping it in a rigorous data structure, and doing it without losing the soul or the debate of the underlying history.
Beautifully said.
And that brings us to the end of today's deep dive. We hope you now have a solid understanding of how the Max name schema actually functions, why that multi-agent AI council was critical to the design process, and how tools like UUIDs and dispute arrays are revolutionizing the way databases handle our past.
It's an exciting time for history.
It really is. But before you go, consider the broader implications of what this technology unlocks. If a data structure, just arrays, strings, URIs, and phonetic keys, can successfully untangle centuries of human linguistic evolution, scribal errors, and cultural erasure, what happens to our understanding of human migration? Imagine a world where AI models can instantly trace a rare, corrupted spelling in a 19th century American census ledger back through a chain of verifiable cognates, linking an anonymous farmer directly to a dominant royal lineage in 12th century Scotland, all in the blink of an eye. What ghosts of history, currently hidden behind centuries of bad handwriting and lost in-all-outs, are just waiting for a schema like this to finally be seen? Think about that the next time you type your own name into a search bar. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.